supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. By the time children are in the ninth grade, one-third of them are sexually active. And by the time they're sexually active, the majority of U.S. teens have not received any formal instruction about contraception. And that trend has continued to grow at an alarming rate. With the dominance now of abstinence-only education, we have to ask how and where are teens learning about sex, and how can parents address this disconnect? We've got several guests on the show coming at it from a variety of different perspectives. First, on the telephone, we have David Landry. He is a senior research associate at the Guttmacher Institute. It's a nonprofit research institute, conducts research on reproductive health and adolescent sexual behavior. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Dan.
I'm also joined on the telephone by Dr. Ruth Westheimer, who I'm sure all of you have heard of, if not heard her directly. She's been in the field of sex education since the 1970s. She's been on the airwaves since 1980. She's written over 30 books. Dr. Ruth, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I'm joined here in the studio by Jan Johnson. She's a health and physical education teacher and faculty advisor with the New Jersey Teen Prevention Education Program. We're going to hear more about that. Jan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Erica Breve. She's a former Teen Pep peer educator, and she's currently a freshman at Stockton College. Erica, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, and our phone number, by the way, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. David, let me start with you with a big question here. How do teenagers get access to sexual education? How do they learn? What's the research show?
Well, some of the latest research is shedding light on where they do not get information from, and unfortunately there has been a pulling back of sex education that is school-based. And, for instance, in your lead-in, you mentioned a little bit about that, but, for instance, in the mid-1990s, 81% of teens got information about birth control from schools, and that has dropped down to two-thirds, or 66%. And then when you probe in a little deeper, you find that within schools, teens are getting much less information, much more substantive information. For instance, they're much less likely to get information on where they can get birth control or where they can go if they think they have an STD for testing. There's even more broader issues that are not being discussed. For instance, ethical or factual information about abortion is much less likely to be discussed, as well as information about sexual orientation. So From a school-based perspective, there's much less going on. Of course, we also know about the explosion of the internet in the last 15 years or so, and that is an area we're currently conducting some research on to see to what extent youth are turning to the internet. And some of the preliminary results, fortunately, show that youth are very skeptical about the information they obtain from the internet, and they don't have a lot of trust for it.
Wow. I am surprised. I must say, pleasantly surprised. So let me turn to you, Dr. Ruth. David's pretty clear and informative about where kids are not getting their sex education. Do you have a sense of where they're getting it?
First of all, David from the Guttmacher Institute. The wonderful thing about them is that they do very serious research. and everybody can rely on it, that it's not just a survey, it's not just an opinion, but it's serious research. I have listened to the Guttmacher Institute for many years. I'm less pessimistic, but I also want to sound a note of warning. It is true that, first of all, in my way of thinking, the entire issue of sexuality education and contraceptive education and education about abortion has to be taken out of the political realm. It has to be in the public health sphere and not being played like a political football. And
I've got to tell you, Dr. Ruth, I've got to tell you, when you said it's got to be taken out of the political realm, my first thought was impossible.
Yeah, I know. But I don't work like that. I don't say it. The word impossible doesn't exist for me. So here's what I did. I did a brand new book, Teachers College, Columbia University, called Dr. Ruth's Guide to Teens and Sex Today, From Social Networking to Friends with Benefits. I am realistic. You are right. But I don't want to waste my time with that. I say, parents, you have an obligation. You have to know what your kids are doing on the computers. We can't just think that the computers don't exist. But I really am very worried. I'm worried about the missing of communication between the parents and the children, because the children are going to say, "We know it all." And I think there's an obligation for parents and schools to sit down together and to talk about it.
Well, I think what you've done, you're touching on so many issues that that I want to open up one by one and look at more carefully. Jan, let's talk to you about this this program, the Teen Prevention Education Program. How does it work? And I also want to know if parents are involved.
Well, how it works is there's approximately 50 schools right now in New Jersey that have Teen Pep. And how it works is that we have a select group of seniors or juniors in our schools. We teach them all the facts and information that they need to know, and we train them to do workshops with our younger kids on different issues around sexuality, postponing sexual involvement, pregnancy prevention, HIV, AIDS, etc.
What do you teach them?
Just about everything. It's a very comprehensive program that we have from A to Z. How to say no, if you can't say no, how to protect yourself, how you get the diseases, what's out there, and everything.
So I want to turn to you, Eric, if I can. You got involved in this program, I assume, when you were a little older, when you were junior or senior in high school. If you can remember way back when, to ninth grade, where were you getting your information?
When I was in ninth grade, I was not a part of the Teen Pep program. I did not receive the workshops.
That's exactly why I want to know. Mm-hmm. What were you learning and where were you learning it?
We had a sex education health class as part of our gym, and they didn't really go in depth. They talked about all the different kind of STIs there are and how you get them and how you protect yourself, things like that. But they didn't really talk about the issues, the peer pressure, the really hard things that you need to learn. You couldn't really ask questions if you had questions about your health or how to do things or how to get yourself out of situations. So it was really just learning from my friends, and I learned from TV and I learned from the internet things.
I'm curious, did you trust what you got from the internet?
It depends. It depends on what site you're on. But sometimes kids, they don't know any better. And whatever they see, they just believe.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I have a question. I need a bit of education. You referred to STI, and I've always called them STD. Are they the same? What's STI mean?
Sexually transmitted infection. They used to be called sexually transmitted diseases, and the reason they changed it is because when you hear the word disease, it sounds very deadly, like, oh, you have a disease. So they changed it to infection to lessen the mental, you know, so you're not as scared about it, because some can be healed and some can't.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. David, let's go back to you about the big picture. You had mentioned earlier that with the shift in education, children are getting less information, and information about birth control continues to decline. But teen pregnancy also continues to decline. It's dramatically down over the last decade, as are teen abortion rates. How do you explain that?
Well, yes, you're right. We were patting ourselves on the back collectively as a field, probably, for the long-term decline in teenage pregnancy. It peaked in 1990, and it has been declining through 2004. Those are the latest stats we have. But the birth rate, which we have a little more information about, for the first time increased in 2006. It was a modest increase of 3%, but this has many people concerned. It's too early to tell whether this marks a change in the trend, but other behavioral data also shows that things have stalled out. For instance, teenage sexual activity was declining throughout the 1990s, and throughout this decade it has been pretty flat. The last three surveys from the CDC show that. Similarly with contraceptive use, that is relatively flat. It had been going through a long period of gains. So things were getting better, and in part the beginning of the decline happened in teenage pregnancy happened before the abstinence only until marriage money hit the country. That happened in about 1997. It's when money's originally came out. So there is concern, though, because the federal government's sole response to teenage pregnancy now is to teach abstinence only until marriage, and the federal regulations for people that accept this money, they are not allowed to talk about how contraception can be used effectively. They can only emphasize its failure rate. So there is some concern, especially with the decline in school-based sex education.
And most public schools do get federal money?
A large number of them do, but it's not, certainly not the majority, but these are also after-school programs, for instance, the feds give some monies directly to programs. But the fact is that sex education in this country is grossly underfunded. The federal government, with the state matching funds since 1997, $1.5 billion has been spent, but when you spread that throughout every school district, it really hasn't reached by a long shot every one of them.
Jan Johnston, how do you get your money for your program? Obviously, there's no federal money here.
No. New Jersey is one of the few states that has actually turned down the federal money. Governor Corzine refuses to change so that we can teach the comprehensive. Our program is funded through our school district. It's one of my regular teaching classes, so it's part of my schedule, so there's no extra money as far as that goes.
I want to shift gears here and talk about peer pressure. Let's bring Dr. Ruth back in. Dr. Ruth, kids have always gotten their information from peers. Yes, I certainly did. Is there a shift in trends? Are children getting more information from peers now that sex ed in school is diminished?
I did the book for parents. Not to ignore the parents. The parents have said, there's nothing we can do about it, it's the peers who will do it. We can't have that, because right now, like all of you other panelists have said, it really changes the picture. We have some very serious worries about young kids giving their addresses on the internet. Parents have an obligation to have an open communication with their kids, to know how dangerous that is. Also, kids don't understand that what they put on their Facebook, what they put on their websites, is there forever. It's not like I'm in a mood being sad and putting something on and say, okay, I'm going to erase it. It's not a diary. It's not something that can be locked up. And I think that the emphasis, in addition of what Jan and everybody is doing, has to be back to the parents to say you have an obligation. You can't just say that's the way it is. You have an obligation to tell your teenagers not to walk around half naked. It is sexually arousing. And I don't want to hear more about sexual, not only harassment, but rape and things that we should be able to avoid.
I do want to address later in the show details about that. The research does show that, you know, parental involvement does have a significant impact with teens, not just with sexuality, with smoking, with drug abuse, so on and so forth. But I want to talk to you in more detail later in the show about exactly how that's done. Most of us didn't hear from our parents, and now we're being asked to talk to our kids. So I think we need our own education. Let's go to the phones before we take a break. By the way, our number is 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about sex education, where kids are learning about sex, where they should be learning about sex, and what the implications are. Again, 888-477-9499. Let's go to George on the line. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yes. I work with a crisis team in my church, and when we do the teen summit, we find out that teens learn most of their habits or most of their experiences come from the household itself. Parents tend to teach kids when they don't know that they're teaching them. So basically, I pretty much agree with Dr. Ruth, because it is the responsibility and always has been the responsibility of the parent or parents or now today parent. So I'm not going to exclude the single mom or the single father. It is your responsibility to educate. And because the parent or parents have failed to do so, now the school system and the state and the federal government must and have to step in and try to remedy the situation. But like Dr. Ruth said, it always goes back to the parent and the parent alone.
Well, I appreciate your call, George, and I want to follow up with Dr. Ruth here. In one of your books, you said that you said the same thing George did, that we teach our parents, our children, one way or the other, and that we pass on unconscious messages.
Mm-hmm. For example, unconscious messages is if one of the parents, and I like what George said about that we have to address single mothers and single fathers. And I want to add to George, because he is in a church-based program, that I always emphasize that if your values, if your morality, if your belief is to wait until the day after the marriage ceremony, stick to that. I keep on repeating that like a broken record. But still, you have to be able to know all about, I like what your young person said, sexual infections, and not to say disease. From now on, I'm going to say infection. And the unspoken way about sex in the home are two things that are important. If the parents have, I'm not talking about the Hollywood type of being in love all the time. Nobody's in love all the time. But a little of that kind of smile and the glimmer in the eye and maybe even a touch on the behind between the father and the mother gives a message that sex is something good, that it's okay to learn about it. And if one of the other has that bad experience of sex being disgusting, children grow up like that.
So it gets taught, whether it gets talked about or not. I was interested in your reaction, Erica, when we talked about children getting unconscious messages from their parents one way or the other. You were nodding your head. Why?
I think that's 100% true. If a child grows up in a household where the two parents are arguing all the time or disrespecting or violence, whether it be emotional or physical violence, when that child grows up, they will think it's normal to treat their spouse the same way.
What's the message when you grow up in a house and parents, I mean, Dr. Ruth talked about parents winking at each other or smiling or touching each other on the behind. What's the message when a kid grows up with the opposite going on, where there's no sexuality, there's no romance between the parents? What's the message kids get?
They might think it's wrong to show that they love each other in front of their children.
Yeah.
I think not the perfect way to grow up, or the best way, would to have a loving family, that they hug each other, they tell each other they love them. Because then when that child grows up, then they have those positive things to remember and those positive things to look back on.
Mm. Let's take a short break, and we're going to come back with more phone calls and more discussion about the role of parents. I want to know more about your program, too, and how it works. We're talking about sex education for our kids today on Voices in the Family. My guests are David Landry. He's a senior research institute with the highly respected Guttmacher Institute. Dr. Ruth is also joining us on the telephone. She's been in the field of sex education since the 1970s. I'm here with Jan Johnston in the studio. She's a health and physical education teacher. She's a faculty advisor with the New Jersey Teen Prevention Education Program. And Erica Brevey is a former teen PEP peer educator, and she's currently a freshman at Stockton, Lucky Stockton. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Support for WHYY is provided by the Newseum, where 5 centuries of news history meets up-to-the-second technology. Now open in Washington, D.C. Details available online at newseum.org.
On the next Fresh Air, ending poverty on a grand scale. Jeffrey Canada set out to change the lives of poor children and created the Harlem Children's Zone, an area that contains thousands of kids. Jeffrey Canada and journalist Paul Tuff explain the ideas behind the controversial social experiment. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
The Economist supports WHYY and presents a night of political satire with their editorial cartoonist and Second City comedy troupe. Tuesday, October 7th, 7 p.m. at Kimmel Center's Perelman Theater. Details at artofsatire.economist.com.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about sex education with David Landry, who's on the telephone. He's a senior researcher with the Guttmacher Institute. I'm joined by Dr. Ruth. Jan Johnston is with the New Jersey Teen Prevention Education Program, and Erica Brevey is a former teen educator with this PEP program. David, I want to go to you and follow up on something with about social norms. I read a study last week that showed that 1/3 of ninth graders were sexually active, but most of them felt that almost all of their peers were sexually active. What are the implications of that? I mean, that really says everything about peer pressure, doesn't it?
It certainly does. It is indeed. For instance, abstinence programs actually have been found to work better when teens think they are going against the world and they can band together with a few other individuals. So some programs have even taken that sense of peer pressure and used it against itself. But it's very common, and ironically, another common feature among teachers is they think that that all parents are against comprehensive sex education, or a large majority of them are. But when in fact public opinion polls show that that from 70 to 80% of parents support comprehensive sex education, that not only gives a strong abstinence message to children, but also the information they need to protect themselves when they are sexually active.
Hmm. I want to follow up on that study with you, Eric, if I can. Way back to when you were in ninth grade, was your assumption that most of your friends were sexually active, and did you feel pressure to become sexually active?
In a way, I guess it depends on what kind of group you associate yourself with. By the way, some girls dress. They do put themselves across as they are sexually active. And if you hang around that type, they try to be something they're not. And they try and put that pressure on you to be like them.
And is that the pressure to be sexually active, or to look like you're sexually active?
I guess it depends on who you are. And depends on how much self-esteem you have. I think if you grow up with a good self-esteem, you don't have to worry about any of that, because you're not trying to make yourself look better than you are.
Yeah.
So if you're confident in yourself, you don't have to dress to make people think you're sexually active. You don't have to worry about any of that, because you're proud of who you are.
Yeah, easier said than done, because if you're not confident, you're not going to get there automatically. And I would think, Jan Johnston, that in today's world it's more difficult for kids to develop self-esteem.
Absolutely. They have so many negative role models, absentee parents, parents that are working, both parents are working, so they're going home to an empty house. So the kids, the role models they get from television are not good ones. So they do get a lot of their messages, whether they're spoken or not, from their peers.
And Dr. Ruth, I want to bring you back in. You know, we were talking about role models, television, and we don't have Dr. Ruth. We have a bad connection with her. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Tanya. Tanya, hi. You're on Voices.
Oh yes, hello.
Hi.
This is actually Ganya Taos Warburton, and I really wanted to participate to this debate. And thank you.
Well, before you do, I've got to ask you to. You have your radio on in the background?
Yes, I do.
Could you turn that off?
Thank you very much. Well, you know, I am actually living the same experience right now. My husband is American. We have been married for 22 years. I am French, but actually a citizen of the world, because I have lived all over the world. And I have to tell you that my children, who were born in this country and are worldly and navigate between Europe, other countries, and the U.S., when they're taught sexual education in schools, it is for us laughable, and it is really dinosaur times. And I have to tell you, it has to do with the emphasis on the trashy, tacky pageant pop culture, the Britney Spears. I think what is repulsive is how young girls are so sexualized. And what I want to say, because my children make that point, is perhaps to teach young American girls that it is sexy to have a fine mind, that it is arousing to be intellectually challenging to the young men, that you can wear white cotton organic underwear and be incredibly sexy, and that, most of all, at home, parents should be role modeling respect, dialogue, intellectual challenge, tenderness. What we see here in this country is sex, 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 sex. Enough of that. This is dinosaur time. I think that young men should be aroused by intellectual finesse, cultural wealth, debate, dialogue, and it starts with the one word, respect.
Well, I think you make a great point, and I want to thank you for your call, and your perspective is certainly interesting. I'm curious about something. Do we have you on the phone, Dr. Ruth?
Yes, yes.
For
some reason, I hope it didn't disconnect because of the comparison with Europe. I love this country. And Europe has their own problems.
Yeah, I know they do. Let me get to
every year they have their own problems.
I want to follow up something specifically with that last question. We know the role models that kids have today, that we all have today, are just abominable and getting worse. But I'm curious about, is there any good role models that you have found in TV and the movies for kids?
That even so it has changed a little bit, like the Guttmacher Institute has taught us, that basically there are less unintended pregnancies. I want to say something, there also, because of all of us, you too, Dr. Dan, talking about it, there are less women who don't know how to have an orgasm, that they have to teach their partners. And there are some role models that we could say to children. It's unrealistic to say, look at Shirley Temple. That was the ideal when I grew up. I thought that this American culture, look what they can produce, a seeing, smiling girl. But what we do have to say is, let's not permit anymore all of this newspapers, but I don't know how to do that. We have to be, I would have to be a dictator of constantly showing half-naked teenagers as if this is not dangerous. In my way of thinking, that is dangerous. Look at the Beatles. I know there will be some smiles because I just turned 80. So for me, I thought the Beatles were wonderful. There were girls could dream about being in love with them and not these tight jeans that we see on boys these days. I don't even know how they can have an erection in those tight jeans.
Maybe that's why they wear them, Ruth.
but to say, look, people, there is something about wonderful about being young, about being full of energy, about having a whole life of sex ahead of you. Be sexually literate. Know all there is to what there is to be known about. That doesn't mean that you should ever succumb to a friends with benefits just because you want a date for Saturday night. And that holds true for boys and girls.
Well, I want to shift the discussion here and talk in more detail about parents talking to their children about sex. David, I want to know about the research and if you know of any research that, you know, of course they play a critical role, but do we know whether they are in fact talking to their children about sex or no?
Well, it is a fascinating area. For instance, surveys both teens and parents show that unknown to parents, teenagers actually regard their parents as being more influential than the parents actually believe them to be. And this is echoing what some of your other guests have said, that it's not just what parents say, but it's how they conduct themselves with their children that makes a big impact. And when it specifically comes to issues around sexual health, it's not sitting down with your child and having one big birds and the bee discussion. It's rather finding many teachable moments. For instance, when a TV program comes up and something seems to be inappropriate, that's the moment when a parent should.
Well, let me ask you something as a researcher, and I'm sure, I mean, this is a researcher's question. You talk about not having the big talk, but many teachable moments. How do you know that? I mean, it seems logical intuitively, but is there research to support that?
Yes. Well. For instance, there are no global program. No one has developed a program for parent-child communication that has gone through experimental design and has been shown to be effective. But there is a lot of evidence just looking at just talking to teens and saying where they got their information from and how they felt it, whether or not it was effective, that teens who experience just one big talk or just some very small commands did not receive that information very, very highly.
Yeah.
There's been some longitudinal data from a survey called the Ad Health, which has followed high school youth now for over 10 years. And that information did show that when teens felt the information their parents were giving them had some fidelity with their own parents' lives, they viewed it much more realistically than when it was just an ushered command. So, for instance, if you're telling your teen to not drink when you're knocking back four drinks in one evening, that is not going to be very effective.
Jan Johnston, I want to understand, in your program, how do you talk about parents? How do you bring the concept of parenting in? And do you ever encourage the young people to bring it up with their parents?
Oh, absolutely. Not only with the Teen Pep kids, but I teach all the sex education at my high school. I always tell my students, whatever we talk about here at class, please feel free to go home and have this discussion at home with your parents. It's easier for the kids to start the discussion than it is for the parents. The parents are, frankly, very uncomfortable with this topic.
So, Erica, how do you talk to your peers about their parents?
It's hard. And not a lot of parents are willing to open up and discuss open issues with their children. You have to tell the student, or to tell the teenager, to bring it up first. Bring it up in a way that it's not so forward, not so afraid that their parents will freak out. I agree with the teachable moment comment that we do a workshop with parents.
You do? That's exactly mm-hmm. what I wondered.
Yeah. We do workshops with parents towards the end of the school year, and we tell the parents to look for teachable moments.
When you say we, you mean you, Erica?
Me and the other 17 Teen Pep educators that were with my year.
The young people.
Mm-hmm. The young people.
And yeah. You're instructing the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Are you instructing them about what teachable moments are?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I remember when I wanted to talk to my daughters about sex, their mother wasn't in the picture, and I wanted to talk to them. One of my daughters says, "Dad, don't I have a God-given right to learn this on the street like everybody else does?" No. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jackie on the line. Jackie, hi.
I'm happy to be on your program. My name's Jackie Levy, and I was fortunate enough to have the ability to use the Unitarian Church as a jump-off point to learn about sex, how I can talk to my daughter about sex in the kindergarten to first grade level, and then fourth and sixth grade level is when they start a program. It's called Our Whole Lives. And it just teaches children the sense of self-esteem, talks about their bodies, how good they are, how beautiful they are, provides accurate information, talks about gender identification, human sexuality, and then they talk about developing interpersonal skills, how you would communicate, make decisions, and solve problems. So I feel very fortunate that I was able to participate in that. And as an adult, you are also given a book called The Parent's Guide to Our Whole Lives. And you, as an adult, also are requested to fill out a blank card. What is it you would like to tell your child about sex? Now, here it is, fourth and sixth grade. They're not confronted with it, hopefully. But you're already at that age sort of trying to tell them, even if you can't say it in a whole big sentence, what you feel should be what you would like them to do in life. Do you want them to wait until after marriage, but if they find a kindred spirit that they feel maybe they would like to participate in sex, which could be healthful,
protect yourself, you are
given a goal as a parent, and you're given the responsibility, and then you're also given these tools to use.
This sounds like a wonderful program, and one of the things we are learning is that many parents need their own education. And when we come back from our break, I want to talk to Dr. Ruth about how parents can get that education. We're talking about teenagers and younger and sex education, where they are learning it and where they are not. My guests are David Landry, who's a research associate with the Guttmacher Institute. I'm joined also by Dr. Ruth on the telephone. I'm here in the studio with Jan Johnston, who's with the Teen Prevention Education Program here in New Jersey, and Erica Brevey, who's a teen PEP peer educator, and she's now at Stockton College. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
The Academy of Natural Sciences supports WHYY. You have your father's nose and your grandmother's smile. Why? At the Academy of Natural Sciences exhibit Gregor Mendel, Planting the Seeds of Genetics, running now through September 28th, visitors can learn about the 19th century friar who discovered how physical traits are passed from one generation to the next. Sponsored by Villanova University and the Academy. These are the final weeks. Details at 215-299-1000 or at ansp.org.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about sex education for our young people. Many of them are sexually active. What are they learning about sex, love, and relationships, and where are they learning it? Let's go right to the phones. We've got Jessica on the line. Jessica, hi, you're on Voices.
Gottlieb, how are you? It's nice to speak with you. I wanted to bring up the point, and it was actually brought up just by the caller right before me, about the age of how to speak to your child and when to speak to them. My husband is a pediatrician. I used to be a pharmacist, so we are a medically based family. And our son is 8, my daughter's 11, and we've been speaking to them at their level, in like we were talking about teaching moments, about openly, about everything, about sexuality, about their bodies, their changing bodies. And I was very glad we had started that when our daughter was about 4, because she ended up getting her menstruation at 10 years old and has had all those physical changes and is very different from a lot of her peers at this time, and awkwardness and all of that peer pressure coming in. And we've been able to set up, because of that, a system where our children, it's not a question, because it's been a lifestyle in our home. And I guess my surprise is that I had a lot of parental peers, my age group peers, who were mortified at the conversations I would have with my children. I mean, nothing was ever beyond the age they can understand, but if my daughter would ask me why a girl was kissing another girl when we were walking in New York, I didn't shush it away. I just explained, well, those are two people who are in love, and sometimes you fall in love with different people, and we left it there. But it always left it as not an unspoken. And I just wanted to ask, you know, am I wrong? I don't think I'm wrong, but I'm just surprised at how many, you know, parents don't address this until the children have started maturing physically.
So,
and that was my question.
Okay, so I'm gonna turn your question over to Dr. Ruth, but I want to shape it a bit. So let's take Jessica's question, Dr. Ruth, and ask I want to know when parents should begin talking to their kids about their sex and how
exactly
do they begin?
Hello. So first of all, let's give a gold star to the pharmacist who just called.
Oh,
well, gold star, because first of all, she did exactly what I keep on preaching, being an askable parent on that level. And especially what she was just saying, our girls these days do menstruate at an earlier age, and it is scary if somehow blood comes out from a place where you didn't expect it. So first of all, bravo to her. I do want to say, and also bravo the way she responded about the same-sex question. She doesn't have to go into all of the details, which she didn't. She doesn't have to talk about transgender and operations. She said there are some people who love members of their own sex at that particular time. But I wanted to put one more thing on the table. I am very concerned about nudity in the home. Now, some people go to nudist camps. Let them have a good time. In general, in our culture, in our society, I would like to say that everybody deserves some measure of privacy. That people, parents should not walk around naked. Their youngsters, their teenagers, could get aroused and would get very scared by being aroused by seeing a mother or father, and the other way around. I'm not saying, going to hysterics when the door opens in the shower.
I have to tell you, your point is well taken, and I underscore that we should certainly cut back on nudity at the home. And we also have to watch what kids are being aroused by. Frankly, I'm much more concerned about kids being aroused by what they're seeing on TV and in the movies is more so than at home. I want to get back to the issue of parents and teaching kids. I know many parents, myself, I was raised in a family where my mother didn't say anything to me. She said it was my dad's job. And I remember my dad one night opened the door while I was in my room, and I'm never going to say what I was doing in there that at the moment. But he opened the door and threw a book on my bed called The Facts of Life and Love for Teenagers, and he closed the door and he ran away. And that was our discussion about sex. So, I mean, I'm a psychologist, so obviously I've learned and had practice, but where's a parent going to learn that, and how's a parent going to know that they need an education, Jan?
Well, I totally agree with you. I had the same situation. If it wasn't talked about in my household either, it was, so it made me feel that if you don't talk about it, then it shouldn't happen. You know, it was a dirty thing because you didn't talk about it.
Well, that's kind of the abstinence only.
Right. Mentality. So, for parents, if they were all like the caller, then I wouldn't have a job. I wouldn't need to teach what I teach. But that's not the way it is. I don't know. Parenting doesn't come with a book. I wish it did. They need to start, like Erica said earlier, too. It starts when they're little, and whatever it is you're talking to them about, it's got to continue across the line from drugs to alcohol to sex.
So, Erica, I'm going to ask you a question that's going to be terribly unfair, and I have to apologize before I ask it. So when your kids are little, if you decide to have kids, little, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, what's the message you're going to give them? And how are you going to give them that message?
Just to love themselves and to love other people and to have respect and to know that the relationship with me is 100% open. I feel if you have an open relationship with your child, then questions aren't as hard. And really taboo topics like sex aren't going to be as taboo if you have an open relationship.
I want to come back to the issue of what to tell our children when and potential conflicts here. So a parent, and I'm turning to you, Jan, a parent ideally is not going to want their child to be sexually active. I mean, I wanted my daughters to not be sexually active until menopause, actually. I wanted my grandchildren to come magically. I don't know.
That's a father thing.
It's a father thing, right. But, I mean, most regular parents don't want their children to be sexually active. And many children are going to be sexually active.
Right.
So that sets up a conflict. How is a parent supposed to deal with it? And what kind of information are supposed to give their children about this?
Well, the more educated they are, the better. It's not an easy situation. The parents come to me back to school night, for example, and we talk about the fact that I will be teaching them sex education, and they say, "I'm better you than me." They're not comfortable with it. I guess the only way around that would be to offer them workshops, classes, when their kids are little, so they can start those discussions when they're young. I think the more educated you are about what's out there and what's going on, the easier it is to have that conversation.
Eric, I'm curious. I wonder if there's a way you or your peers, your educated peers, could help parents with their anxiety about their own ignorance.
We do offer a workshop towards the end of the year just strictly for parents. And they come and they sit, and it's usually maybe two peer educators to a group of about 12 parents. And we start off examining how they were taught and the things they learned when they were young. And then from that, they form all these questions that they want to ask their teen, but they can't. And then they ask us. So in a way, they're breaking that boundary. They're talking to us first, seeing, you know, trying to get their feet wet, seeing the kind of answers they're going to get. I think parents are afraid of the answers that they're going to get from their children.
Do you know what they're afraid of?
The truth. I do. I don't want to call parents naive, but it's going to happen. Your teen is going to have sex. Your teen is going to get involved with another boy or a girl, and things are going to happen. And I feel bad because parents are so afraid of it, but they shouldn't be. Because it's natural. That's what happens.
Yeah, and even though it might not have happened in their generation, it's going to happen in this generation. Yeah, and they do. I think the issue with almost all parenting these days is, you know, you just have to manage your own anxiety. Mm-hmm. Your anxiety is not a call to action, and it's not even necessarily a danger signal. It's simply your anxiety that has to be dealt with. And if you parent by anxiety, the whole family is going to be in trouble. Believe it or not, we are out of time, and we could have done this for another 2 or 3 hours easily. I want to thank all of my guests so much for joining us. My guests have been David Landry, Dr. Ruth, John Johnston, and Erica Brevey. Landry is a research associate with the Guttmacher Institute, a nonprofit that conducts research on reproductive health and adolescent sexual behavior. David, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Ruth has been in the field for
100 years,
and hopefully.
And I would like Erica to do that wonderful seminar that she does, the beginning of the school year.
Yeah, that's. I was thinking that just as she said it. I want to underscore that the beginning of the school year, please. I think it would be much more helpful then. Anyway, the Erica we were just referring to is Erica Brevey. She is a former teen prevention education program educator. She's currently a freshman at Stockton College and has a bright future, I'm confident. I'm also joined here in the studio by Jan Johnston. She is a education associate. If you've got questions, we're at voices@.org. The engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Paris-Loon is executive producer for radio content. Mike and Scott's the executive producer of the show. We're produced by Elisa Walters and Gita Simons. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.
Next time on Day to Day.
Eins und zwei.
Dance instructor Michael Songer is a second-generation German. But like others in Germany with foreign backgrounds, he's treated like an outsider.
They think Turkish youngster tries to be a gangster. They even don't know that I finished my university and that I'm a businessman.
A growing group of citizens tries to fit into Germany's future. Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.